Hi.
Hi. That makes a difference. Turning it on makes a difference. Hi. Okay. Can you hear me in the back? Will you? Amy, can you hear me? Can you hear me? Yeah. Thank you. My informant in the back. Okay. Hi. Wednesday. Already. 25th. 2 months till... You got it. And... and 7 days till November and 6 days till your favorite... Your birthday?
Yeah.
When?
November 16th.
Okay. Anybody else have a birthday November 16th? No. Okay. Yes? No. What's the probability that any two of you have the same birth date? About 100%. About 100% in here. Okay. Well, enough of that foolishness. And 5 days till an exam in here. And okay. Review session today after class in Fleming 101. Thursday at 5, Sunday at 5. Exam as, well, the exam isn't on that page, but there you go. The exam is, I will record the review sessions if I remember to and if the equipment works, and yes, I will put all three of them up. As soon as I can. So. How many of you have used the recordings? Are they useful?
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. All right. Good.
That's an increasing number over previous semesters. So I appreciate knowing that you're using them. Other faculty have asked me if it's a lot of trouble. In fact, I had a call this afternoon about that. And, you know, now that I know how to do it, if I remember to turn it on and don't accidentally turn it off, it takes me about 5 minutes or three to convert it to an MP3 and put it up. So it's not a big deal for me. But so even if only one or two of you were using it, it would be worth doing it for me. But it's very gratifying to see that people are using it and finding it useful. So I appreciate knowing that. I'm not going to spend time on it right now. I'm censoring myself. I was about to say we're engaged in another piece of technology to try to see if we can do voice recognition of the lectures so that we could actually produce text, so you could have a Word document of whatever I had said, but apparently the technology is pretty far away from being able to do that, but we're going to try it anyway. Not this semester, but next semester. Pushing the limits on that. If any of you have suggestions about ways that we can use technology to enhance the accessibility of any of the material in the course, I'm always open to those suggestions, and I'm part of a project now that is using this course and my next semester course to try out things that might help. It's called universal design, making all the information accessible to anybody who wants it in whatever format would be useful to them. So it's kind of a neat challenge. Questions? I will, just as a reminder, no, not that one. Where is it? Oh, here. Technology. Right. Trust me with technology. The exam is Monday, and if your last name starts with A through F, you will take it in Bodie. Everybody else will take it here. Take a number two pencil. Same format. Did we talk about the essays being more points? Did you promise? Okay. I think the essays are worth 10 points this time each instead of 7. So. What that means is that there's more points possible on this exam, and that will be the same. There will be more multiple choice questions on the third exam, and what that means is that now that you've had the first exam and have been traumatized by that, but know how to prepare better for it and what to anticipate, it means that performance on the first exam will be less important than performance on the second or the third, to give you an opportunity to demonstrate and get more points for demonstrating that you've actually overcome the first exam. That's the rationale for that. And we'll try to grade them a little more generously this time. That'll help. Right? Okay. Anything else I need to say about the exam? Okay. They've got all that. All right. Schemas. Cognitive development. Let me say a few more things about adolescents and what adolescents are becoming able to do compared to children. And then we'll talk about adulthood. And cover some of the key concepts from the chapters on adulthood. We'll talk about how childhood and adolescence are different from adulthood and what sorts of changes we see across adulthood. Okay, so as we were talking about what adolescents do in the chemical combinations, I gave you my version of what it is that children at different stages would do, starting with the sensory motor messing around with whatever the stimuli are, to being able to talk about the stimuli and in the pre-operational period, and then as you get into elementary school years, the concrete operational, being able to describe it more intelligently and more logically because you're learning both the grammar of the language and the grammar, in a sense, of how things go together in the real world, and the concrete operations that the child is practicing during the elementary school years lets the child deal with the known world in very logical ways. And kids are, during those years, picking up a lot of information, and they're developing much larger schemas. They're able to connect their schemas in more complex ways and access them more quickly. And they're also throwing away some of the ideas that don't work. They're pruning those ideas and getting away from some of their fantastical notions and some of the things that they believe as they get more and more immersed in concrete reality. And for some kids, particularly as they get into that concrete reality and learn the difference between fantasy and reality and are able to think fairly logically about the real world, they become interested in the truth. They want to have black and white true answers to things. They don't like problems that are ambiguous. And then, as they're coming up toward adolescence, what we see is a shift in that, and I call it intellectual puberty, parallel And at about the same time as the biological puberty that kids are going through, and I'll just say parenthetically, we don't really know very much about the connections between the biological changes of puberty and the intellectual changes of puberty, because essentially that research has not been done. It's frustrating to me, because I would like to know that as the brain changes in particular ways, as kids' bodies change in particular ways, you see changes in their thinking. And the little bit of research that we have suggests that that's a pretty messy kind of transition to try to get your hands around and your mind around. What is interesting to me, and has been for a long time, is that the timing of the two events, the transition through puberty into adulthood, which makes it possible for you to reproduce, and the transition intellectually that make you think like an adult, maybe not having enough information or experience to use it, but using the same logic that adults do as you move into formal operational thinking. These two are happening at roughly the same time, but there's also a tremendous amount of variability that we don't know about. We know the variability is there, but we don't know why it's there. My point is that you will see kids, you will see one kid, I'm struggling with how to draw this, but longitudinally what's happening is that you're going through puberty physically, and some kids are going through the intellectual changes at the same time. So they're going through formal operational development. They're learning to think like adults through that same time. Synchronous development. They're in sync with each other, synchrony. Other kids are going through that formal operational change before. And they're the little kids. They're literally children. They're typically late maturers physically. They're later than other kids, but they're average or even early intellectually. And what's happening is they are thinking far beyond their bodies. And they're looking at problems and curriculum in a much more logical and sophisticated way, but they're presenting themselves in little kid bodies because they're not through puberty yet. And life is often very frustrating for them because the teachers look at them and the physical development is what you see, and you see a little kid. Maybe in eighth grade, but he looks like a little kid because he's not gone through puberty. And he's thinking intellectually, and his experience, and some of you probably had it, is that people aren't taking him seriously. Or when he thinks at the level that he's actually able to think at, they think he's a smart aleck, when in fact he's just showing more mature thinking. So he's out of sync, and it's frustrating for him to have his intellectual development ahead of his biological development, though if I were going through puberty again, that's what I would want to have happen, because I would be able to think seriously about things before I had to worry seriously about other aspects of life that happen when you go through biological puberty. And then there's the third group, who are typically early maturers physically, and they may be average in their intellectual development, average timing of that, but it's behind their bodies. And what we know about the early maturers biologically is that they're much more likely to get into trouble. And we all know that that's because their thinking isn't up with their bodies, and they get into situations that they may not be prepared for. One way to understand that and to look at it is, how are they thinking? Are they still thinking in an unsophisticated, concrete, operational way while their bodies are not only telling them to do other things, but when people are looking at them, people are looking at the mature body, and their expectations are that they will behave in mature fashion. So they get into situations based on their physical appearance that they can't handle intellectually. But the expectations are there. So they have a different kind of stress, a different kind of frustration, which is that people are expecting them to be mature in their thinking, but they're not. So as you think about the connection between the biological development and the intellectual development, think about the timing of that and whether you're synchronous, so everything is changing at the same time, or whether you're not going through both changes at the same time. And life and adolescence may be very different if you're going through the intellectual changes before you go through puberty, or if you go through puberty before you go through the intellectual changes. And when we experience adolescence differently, the relative maturity in each of those two domains may be a contributor to the fact that some of us have different kinds of difficulty in adolescence than do others. Okay, does that make sense? It's a very important part of understanding adolescent development and why some kids who look mature are having difficulty. I could elaborate on that, but I'm not going to. Self-censoring. Okay, so what happens then is that we go through this change, the intellectual puberty, and we add this new set of skills that we call formal operations. And I've said several times that they're called formal because they're based on the shape or the form or the pattern, the nature of the schema, not its content. So you can apply them to any kind of information or concept, including concepts that don't exist. So you can deal with hypothetical situations, contrary to fact, Elkind calls them. So you can reason about things that you don't know about, which is fun in adolescence, right? We start to think about things we don't know anything about. We even have arguments about things we don't know anything about, because we can. We understand the scheme of arguing. We can think about how things might be, the hypotheticals, even if we don't have any real experience with them. So it makes us look much more intelligent. And some of us then base our entire careers on talking about things we don't know anything about. I didn't say that. And I'm not referring to any faculty you know. The key concept for me in understanding what happens at adolescence and what we do in adulthood is that we're looking for the isomorphism or the similarity in pattern and the dissimilarities, and we have the intellectual capability to examine how things in the world or ideas are similar or dissimilar. That can sometimes get us into trouble, and an example came up today in a conversation. The situation that you're all familiar with, having done the exam analysis, I mentioned before, many of you had difficulty with the all of the aboves. Okay. And in a conversation today, it occurred to me that that's actually an example of expecting isomorphism, and when the problem doesn't fit, having difficulty with it. And here's what I think happens on those questions. The psychologists would call it having a cognitive set. The cognitive set is a way of looking at things, and that's a complex scheme. Okay. And I think what happens on those problems, and I hadn't thought about it before, but I think, let me throw this out as an example, a possibility, I think that when we do a multiple choice exam, when we look at each question, our set, our scheme is find the things that are wrong. And so we go through, we look, and we throw out clearly, the choices that we know are wrong. They're absurd, they're illogical, or we just know them to be wrong. And we come down to the ones that might be right. And maybe there's just one and we know it. Maybe there are two and we have to think about them a little bit and figure out why one is better than the other. And we go through the questions looking for the wrong things. And then we come to one that doesn't have anything wrong, but we're looking for something wrong. So we start eliminating. That's applying the same scheme to the new problem. The difficulty with it is that there isn't actually anything wrong. And the way we resolve the disequilibrium of that is to force something to be wrong. We start looking for the little flaws in each of the statements rather than stepping back and saying, oh, maybe a different scheme. Aha, maybe I have to look for all of these being right. But that's a different scheme. Why are they all right? So I think what the difficulty is that we're going through with our same scheme and applying it, and when it doesn't fit, we change the items, we change our response, rather than changing our scheme and saying, ah, maybe this is one of those questions. So what I'm warning you about is, here's a skill. Go into the questions with two schemes. One, looking for what's wrong so you can eliminate the possibilities. And the second, looking for what's right and entertaining the hypothesis that maybe they're all right. And the clue to kick off that scheme is whenever the answer includes, one of the answers is all of the above, activate that scheme, which is a different scheme. Differentiate your approach to the two kinds of problems. And you're making your exam-taking schemes more sophisticated. And then what you want to be able to do, in Piaget's sense, is coordinate those two schemes, finding what's wrong and looking for what's right, so you can move back and forth between them depending on the nature of the problem. And when you have difficulty finding something that's wrong, switch quickly to the other scheme and seeing maybe if that one works. And you'll be developing cognitively and doing better on the exam. Does that make sense? Both as an illustration of using formal operational thinking and applying the notion of isomorphism to the exam. Somebody nod yes, please. Thank you. You're all thinking so hard, you can't nod. That happens. I do that too. Okay, let me look at some other examples of things that we begin to see people doing in adolescence. And sometimes we expect these before kids are formal operational and we lose them, we confuse them. And I've taken these from literature because many of us have difficulty in 7th and 8th grade because that's when they try to teach us about literary symbolism and metaphor, and we are lost. If we're still concrete thinkers, we've got a story and it has characters and it has a plot and we know that, and we take it literally rather than figuratively. We don't, figurative means we deal with symbols, with metaphors. We know that things don't always just mean what they say. They also have other meanings. And the other meanings are the basis for symbolism or the basis for simile or metaphor. And literature and its richness depend on being able to see the isomorphisms between meanings. And 7th and 8th grade teachers of English often run into the problem that many of their kids are not yet formal operational and they don't get it. And we frustrate them terribly by trying to get them to read poetry and sort out the symbols or to write similes or metaphors. And what most of us remember about similes and metaphors is if it has as or like, it's a simile. If it doesn't, it's a metaphor. That's what we remember, right? If we point it out, it's a simile. If it's like or as, then they're saying it's the pattern should be isomorphic. In these cases, my love is like a red, red rose. Who's that? Browning? Anybody know the poem by heart? Make a note for me to actually get the poem so I can put the whole thing up. Anybody remember the poem, My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose? Yeah. What's it about?
I don't remember.
Okay. What do you think from there? It's a simile. My love is like a red, red rose. Okay. So it says right there, my love and the red, red rose are like. Like means isomorphic. Okay. Aha. So what we're going to look for in that poem is a description of a rose, a red, red rose, not yellow, red, red, we're going to emphasize that, and my love. And we're going to look point for point whether it's the same pattern. In what ways is her love like a red, red rose? Got thorns? Smells sweet to some of us? Has its feet in the dirt? Full of bugs? I don't know, you know, whatever you can think about for a rose. And I'm not quite sure, because I don't remember, that's why I need to get the poem and look it up again, is, and maybe it's ambiguous, is the author writing about her love, the act of loving, the state of love, that process, that transaction, or is she talking about the person that she loves? It's an ambiguous statement. So now we get to have a debate about the similarities of Red Red Rose. Is she talking about her loving, the state of being in love, or the process of loving, or is she talking about the person? Which simile works? Do they both work? Is there a real depth in there that it could apply both to what she's doing in loving and what her lover is doing in receiving that? But it's a question about isomorphism. You have to be able to take the plant from botany, home and garden horticulture, and this ephemeral feeling of love, or this person, and figure out how to put them together. That's what a simile requires. And that's why you didn't understand what they were doing in sixth grade or seventh grade. Symbolism is the line I made up. Storm clouds gathering over the treaty discussions. Does that mean these folks are out having a treaty discussion and it's going to rain on them? Probably not. It's a symbolism. In what sense are storm clouds like whatever is about to happen to these treaty discussions? What could that refer to?
Tension,
conflict, the attempted assassination of a royal duke, increasing bad vibes between the two countries is going to derail the treaty discussions. Okay, so they're going to get more difficult. They're going to be all wet. Our language is full of the isomorphisms. Metaphor, we've talked about when the cat's away. Irony. Irony actually is used in two different ways. The dictionary definition is a figure of speech in which the words express a meaning that is often the direct opposite. So we walk out in the rain today and say, beautiful weather, huh? And the other use of irony is also an example of an isomorphism, an abstract isomorphism, because in the other use of irony, what you have, is, for example, in a novel, is somebody who does something nasty to somebody else and then does it to yet another person. This becomes a pattern. This is the character. This is a person who cheats. And what's the irony? The irony is at the end, somebody does it to him. Okay? So you have the isomorphism. I do this, I do this again, I do this again. It's just like the number of relations. I do this, I do this, I do this. Somebody does it to me. And the power and the humor of the story is hoist on his own petard. That's a phrase you all remember, right? How many of you have been hoisted on your own petard? Right. How many of you know what a petard is? What's a petard? P-I-T-A-R-D. French Revolution. It's a pike. And it has a spear point. And then it has some curved barb things. And you use it to do nasty things to other people. And the phrase, hoist on his own petard, means you got what you were doing to other people. And that's what the phrase means, that you've done something to other people and then they do it to you. Not only do they do it to you, they do it with your own weapon. That makes it even worse. They take it away from you and hoist you on it and hang you out to dry. All right, enough. Satire. Alice in Wonderland. Great story, right? How many of you read it? How many of you studied English royal history using English royal politics using Alice in Wonderland? None of you. Go back and read it. How many of you are taking an English history course? Well, go take an English history course, political history in the 19th century, and then read Alice in Wonderland and get one of the guides that will tell you who the characters are. The Cheshire Cat is a neat idea, but it also refers to a particular person. The whole thing is a satire. It refers to specific people, specific relationships, and it's a great story. Great story for kids, but if you know English history, it's even funnier because he's describing specific people. Dr. Strangelove. Yeah. Yeah. Werner von Braun. Yeah, he's right there in the story. Who was president? Lyndon B. Johnson. It's a direct satire. It's a direct takeoff on the Secretary of Defense, Werner von Braun, the President, whoever the Russian was at that point. And it works if there is isomorphism between the piece of literature or the film and the reality. If there isn't, it's an interesting story, but it's not nearly as entertaining or rich as it is as an isomorphic example. And I talked about hypocrisy, so enough. In other words, all the things that you really enjoy about literature and film and often music is based on your ability to understand and use abstract isomorphism. We talked about compare and contrast questions. I think I used Plato's theory of love and Aristotle's theory of love. They probably didn't have theories of love. They have theories of truth, I know that. And what you're asked to do in a compare and contrast question is to understand one system, Plato's, another one, Aristotle's in this case, and to look at how they're the same, that's the compare part, and how they're different, that's the contrast part. And some of us have difficulty in philosophy and political science and other courses because we look at a question that is compare and contrast and we talk about both systems, but we don't really do either the comparison or the contrast. Or we do the compare and forget the contrast and get half credit. What you understand using full formal operational logic is that you have to look at both. You have to describe both, and you have to present your answer or your essay in a way that indicates that you understand both systems, and then you can compare and contrast them, and you have to do both if that's what the question asks for. So you make the, this gets multi-layered. You are comparing and contrasting. You have to know the two theories, okay? And then you have to compare and contrast. But you also then have to have another isomorphism, and this is one that sometimes escapes us, which is the isomorphism between your answer, the essay that you've written, and the question that was asked. When the question says, compare and contrast, you have to do both, or your answer doesn't fit the question. It's not isomorphic. Okay, so when we fully have our formal operational reasoning in place, these are some of the things that we expect adolescents and adults to be able to do. So, we assume there's a systematic set of possible combinations or possibilities, as you did in the permutations problem, the coins, and in the chemical combinations. We expect you to understand the need to record information when there's too much to remember, the metacognition notion. I understand the limits of my brain, my mind. We expect you to be able to derive and test hypotheses using hypothetical deductive logic, and that's scientific thinking. Okay, what's your hypothesis? How are you going to test it? What's the basis for your hypothesis? How do you derive that hypothesis from the information that you already have? In the chemical combinations, you had some information, and that led to possibilities, which you framed as hypotheses, and then we tested them. You can coordinate two or more different systems of reference into a single complex structure. Train A leaves the Paris station at 8 o'clock in the morning, going whatever. So you're coordinating distance and speed and time, all of which are separate systems, into complex coordinated systems, so that you understand that if you maintain a constant speed for a particular period of time, you will cover a particular distance. But if you go at a different speed for that same amount of time, you will cover a different distance. And you can put those two together. We expect that you can look at the similarities and dissimilarities of complex relationships. Current topic. You're all going to vote in a couple of weeks, right? For the right people. If you want to know who they are, just ask. I'll tell you who they are. But that means that you need to be able to look at the Republican platforms and the Democrat platforms and see where they're the same and where they're different. And where they're the same, then it doesn't matter who you vote for. Where they're different, that should be the basis of your vote. And then you have to think about what you in fact believe about what should be done and how to do it, and you find that the Democrats and the Republicans have quite different beliefs about what government should do and how to go about, even if they agree on how to do something like build the economy, they have different assumptions, different systems of belief and thought about how to get there. So you vote for the one that's more consistent with your belief about how things get done. And for voting, you have the very clear awareness of what the ads are about. Right? Political ads are designed to give you a soundbite that you will bite on and believe, even though it represents nothing about either candidate. It's strictly designed for the uneducated voter who's not going to look at real platforms or theories, and decide who or she, who he or she ought to vote for on the basis of basically ignorance. That's why advertising works, because there are enough voters out there who don't know anything about the theories. But they're choosing between Aristotle and Plato, but they don't know what the theories are. So you're not going to do that because you're educated people. So you're going to look at both, and you're going to pay no attention to ads, except perhaps to vote against any candidate who uses ads that are more offensive than the candidate who has the beliefs that you believe in. Okay. So that's how adults use their formal operational thinking. They understand advertising and marketing and can separate themselves from it. Yeah, sure, I'm going to go buy a Lincoln SUV because they have the prettiest women draped over the SUV in the ads. That tells me a lot about whether I should buy an SUV and whether it will meet my purposes. If I want a chick magnet, I'll get a sailboat. Yeah. Abstract systems of relationships. That's what politics, government, advertising, the choice of an SUV or a Prius or any of those other things are about. You have to understand them in their more complex process, and we expect educated adults to be able to do that. What happens after? So you get all that together by the time you finish college, and you keep adding information. You never stop making your schemas more complex, and you never stop being able to relate unrelated things together and to think about them and compare them. And what you eventually do over adulthood is begin to put your experience into complex schemas that you can apply to new situations. So it's based not on what you've read or what you've heard, but on your accumulated experience that has been processed and you've made sense out of it. And that leads you eventually, if you have enough experience in particular areas of life, it permits you to become an expert. It may permit you to become a consultant. It may permit you to become wise. It may qualify you to become a grandparent, because grandparents are valued for their experience if they convert it into understandable schemas. And if they can share those schemas with you, then we value them as grandparents.
If you have an adolescent that isn't at the formal operational reasoning, and you immerse them into that 8th grade literature class, are you going to kickstart that, or are they going to, will it excel, or is everybody on their own, they'll hit it when they're ready to hit it?
Interesting question. The question is, if they're not at that point yet, if you immerse them in a situation like the 8th grade literature class and give them lots of experience, will you bring them up into formal operations? Perhaps. It depends. Now, what you did was give me the perfect opening to say, well, why does development happen? And why does development happen? That's an excellent question. Why does development happen? And that's not it. You're on your edge of your seats, right? Why does development happen? Well, if you're Piaget, there are four major causes of development. This is on the website. Don't frantically copy it down. And if it's not, Talia will tell me. Okay, why does development happen cognitively? Maturation. Your brain is changing. If you're in eighth grade with a 10-year-old's brain, you're probably not going to use that experience to become formal operational. Okay, because you're not at that point where your brain can process the information in that way. The unanswered question is, how much does experience influence the maturation of the brain? Answer that one, you're in for a Nobel Prize in physiology. How much does experience influence the maturation of the brain? We know we can traumatize the brain and slow its progress. We have absolutely no information on humans about the ability of experience, challenge, demand to accelerate the maturation of the brain. We have zilch, not a single shred of evidence. Either way, we don't know whether you can. So if I were doing my career all over again, if I were starting another one, when I get reincarnated, I'm going into neurobiology. Or I'm going to be a circus clown, one or the other. Maturation. Experience. Activity. People develop cognitive skills because they are engaging in actions in the world. They are developing those schemas. They are applying them. The schemas of familiar activities, the actions that we observe, the consequences of those actions that we observe, phenomena to be explained because we experience them, that's all part of experience. And the experiences of failure to effect desired outcomes. Failures. We didn't do it. We don't understand it. Those all are part of experience, important part of experience, and contribute to progress in development. Piaget was one of those wonderful people who said, if you have never failed at something you've tried, you have missed life's greatest opportunities to grow. Failure challenges you to change the way you do things. A friend of mine just finished a book in which he interviewed 60 successful entrepreneurs, people who've made fortunes starting companies. That's his field. That's what he studies. And one of the 60 was an old man who has started over 40 companies. His goal in life has been to start a company a year. And when he comes into my friend's business class to talk about entrepreneurship, he doesn't talk about the 20 or 25 successes he's had, companies that he's started and sold for a profit, which is why he's a millionaire several times over. He talks only about the failures. Because in every case, he said, he learned more from the failure than he did from the success. Social transmission. That's one of the things that's going to happen in that eighth grade class. You're going to talk about the literature. You're going to share ideas. You're going to challenge each other. And that's what education is about. The social transmission of ideas. And Piaget was a very strong proponent, particularly in talking about becoming formal operational. He was convinced that the kind of arguments that peers begin to have in adolescence is a significant contributor to the development of mature intellectual skills. So if you don't argue, if you don't have the conversations and share ideas, if you're not talking about the basic principles of things that are happening in your class, you're missing the opportunity to learn them. That the give and take with other people, the disagreement about what the professor meant or what the reading means, that kind of give and take argument causes you to put a position out, get some disequilibrium, revise your position and revise it and put it out again and encounter challenges. And that kind of argument and discussion refines your thinking, refines your schemes, causes you to coordinate them better. So people who miss argument, who don't like argument because they think it means we don't like each other, are missing the opportunity for part of that important social transmission. It's in talking about and arguing about ideas that you come to understand them. Just reading about them won't necessarily be enough. Talking about them, you really understand them. And then the fourth cause is equilibration, and that's the internal process of revising your schemes, of transforming your understanding in response to the arguments, in response to the experience. So in a sophisticated understanding of cognitive development, it's not this or that. You know, which is more important is not an important issue. It's how do all of these four things work together? I have to have experience, action in the real world, I have to be trying things out, I need to be exposed to the concepts and talk about them and hear other people talk about them, the social transmission part. My brain needs to be far enough along that I can make use of it. That's not an issue after puberty. After puberty, that's not an issue for most of us. Our brains will be able to process anything that comes along if we have enough information and experience under it. That doesn't mean I can learn to speak Portuguese, but it means if I had enough, I could learn to speak Portuguese. And something needs to be going on inside. I have to be processing my understanding actively. I have to be trying to make sense out of things. I can't let life and experience just wash over me. I need to be thinking about it and organize and reorganize my understanding. So we hope you do that. Thank you for that question, Lisa. Okay. Let me talk about some of the people who are discussed in the book. So you know I think they're important. Bill Perry, William Perry, is described briefly about this much in the text. Perry spent his career studying how people's thinking and their ethics change as they go through college and graduate school. So he was interested in where are you when you come out of high school? In your thinking, in your ability to think about important issues, and how does that affect your college education when you come into college? And what happens if you don't go to college? What happens if you don't have the kinds of experiences with advanced and sophisticated ideas that people get in college? And he was a supporter of the notion that everybody needs to have the intellectual opportunity, whether it's in college or someplace. Doesn't matter where it is, but they need to have the social transmission of important ideas. And I should turn this over because I like to do the lower levels on the bottom and move them up, but this one has the first stage is really a concrete operational stage with formal operational skills added to it, at least enough so that you understand there are right and wrong answers to complex problems. And Perry argued that sometime toward the end of high school, some people leave this stage, but many people come into college at this stage that he calls dualism. And what he means is that they are looking for the right answers, and they're not comfortable with ambiguity. They don't like my permutations problem because it depends. They want to know the right answers. And their model is math and physics, but not too sophisticated physics. And they like tests that have right and wrong answers, and they expect that faculty in college will know the answers and will share them. So my job, from a dualistic student's perspective, is to tell you what's right and what's wrong, and you shouldn't have to do much thinking in order to know what's right. Needless to say, I'm a failure. Then there's a stage in which people begin to get shaken up. There's a lot of disequilibrium that happens for dualistic people when they get into a college kind of situation or in a good, sophisticated high school curriculum. They're encouraged to think, to come up with alternatives, to think about different ways, to criticize, and to come up with critiques about things that aren't really clear. And they begin to understand that there may be several different answers, but that only reflects, for some of them, the notion that we don't know everything yet. But when we do, there'll be a right answer. So they accept that psychologists can't tell you which of the theories is the right one. Okay. We can tell you which one's useful but not right. Or economists have three or four different theories about gross national product and how to boost it. Eventually we'll figure out that one of them is right, but right now we don't know that yet. And then eventually where we're going, and we hope you get there before you graduate, college is easier if you get there earlier, is an understanding that there might be more than one right answer depending on the perspective, and that most understanding needs to be looked at in context. And the person who claims to have the right answer may be the least intelligent person in the room. If there is a person who insists that his answer is the only one possible right, then you need to consider that person potentially dangerous. If you want a wonderful book about that, the title is The True Believer. And it's about people who have one idea and their idea is right and everybody else is wrong. And essentially it suggests that you consider people who have the right idea and everybody else is wrong, you consider them potentially dangerous. It requires a good deal of relativism to reject the notion that any particular idea may be the only one. And that really, that relativism, along with the skills to examine positions and arguments and complex systems, is what college is about. A wonderful example of that, Dale Goldhaber, the chairman of our department, and I used to team teach this course. And one of the wonderful things about team teaching, it was also a year-long course, one of the fun things about it was that we would take different sides, or we would take different parts of the course. And there are areas in which Dale and I do things quite differently. And we thought, being relativistic and having that goal for our students, we assumed, naively, starting out in teaching this course, that it makes a richer experience if students get two different views. And then we got our course evaluations. And some students, not all, but the dualistic ones, took us to task and rated us low because we disagreed with each other. They couldn't deal with the fact that we had different views on some things. And we weren't saying, my view is right, his view is wrong. We were saying, well, here are two different views. And our exam questions were, here are our two, what's yours? And students couldn't deal with that. And so we learned something. And I went and read Perry then. And I hadn't read him before. And discovered, oh, okay, we can expect that. My favorite example was when we were talking about gender equity in marriage. And Dale and I both are very strong believers in gender equity, equal amounts of work for husband and wife. Okay. And we both had wives who also believed in that very strongly, which may explain why we did. And it's a transaction. But we will push that notion that, you know, if there's gender inequity in your relationships, you need to examine whether that's deliberate or whether you've just absorbed the wrong ideas from the culture, the stereotypic traditional ideas, the ones in which the women do all the work and the men watch football. That's not gender equity. So Dale and his wife had worked out their scheme for gender equity, which was to divide all of the chores down the middle. And they alternated. So each of them did the grocery shopping half time. Each of them vacuumed half the time. So they just split all of the chores right down the middle. And okay, it's my week to vacuum, it's your week to grocery shop, next week we switch, and therefore everything was equitable. And that's a really neat, simple way to do it. My wife and I had decided that we would do it differently and still considered it gender equity. She stayed home, raised the kids, took care of the house, kept me on the right track because she didn't want to work. She thought her place was in the home. And I took care of outside stuff, and we made sure that we both were on board with appreciation and respect for what the other person did. That's another way to do gender equity. It's saying, okay, I, meaning me, love to shop for groceries. And I like taking little kids to the grocery store. there are not a lot of men who, I've met a lot of men who won't do that. I love it. If you want me to go shopping with your kids when you have them, if you have them, just I'll take them. I love to go through the grocery store with little kids. It's lots of fun. So I did the grocery shopping, you know, and parented at the same time. We took the jobs and did which ones we felt most comfortable with and really enjoyed. That was one of the issues where students wanted to know what the right way to do it was, and our point was there are many ways to do it. The overarching principle, the isomorphism, is gender equity, but there are lots of different ways to get there. The important thing is that you talk about it and are comfortable with the way you've done it, not his way is the right way or my way is the right way. Gender equity we agreed on, but students didn't. Some students didn't grab that. Okay? So that's what Perry's about, that notion of becoming more relativistic as you encounter more and more sophisticated ideas in college and beyond. And then there's Werner Schei. And Schei has another set of stages that I also need to draw the other way because I put them up here from top to bottom when I really want the lower levels at the bottom. It's easy to redo these, but remind me to. So Schei says that what happens is we spend childhood and adolescence acquiring intellectual skills. And he doesn't go into much more than that. And as we do that, we become formal operational thinkers. And then we spend a few years in a stage he calls achieving, which is using what we've acquired to achieve something, to get a job, to pay the bills, to learn to be a nurse or a physician, whatever it is we're doing, to become a lawyer, to demonstrate that we have the intellectual skills to do whatever it is that we're trying to achieve. Then as we get into usually early middle age, we begin to use our intellect for other purposes, and instead of focusing on our own achievement, we begin to take on responsibility, particularly for other people. And he developed this system of stages by interviewing people over time about what they did with their minds. It's an interesting question. Go ask your parents what they do with their minds and why they do it and what satisfaction they get out of whatever the thinking is that they do. And then he distilled hundreds of interviews over time into what he thought the general patterns were, and he called those these stages, so he labeled them. Okay, so we're acquiring the skills, then we're using them to achieve something for ourselves, and then we're using them to carry out responsibilities, often responsibilities for and to other people, and then our focus becomes on managing all those responsibilities and getting things done in a way that keeps us sane. And then as we go up into late adulthood, we often enter a period when what we're interested in doing is reorganizing what we know and applying our skills to new kinds of things. And the reorganizational period, that it often hits people as they prepare for retirement or as they cope with retirement or loss of a job or a late midlife crisis that says, I hate my job. I'm going to go do something different. I'm going to use my mind in some new or different way. How do I reorganize my thinking to accommodate that and use my mind for something else? And then as we go into old age, we reintegrate, and that's a kind of formal sense-making period. How do I make sense out of the experiences that I've had? And that often blends with how do I share what I have learned, what I've done with my mind, to create something to pass on? Okay. How do I create a legacy? Okay. I'm not going to go into examples of that. But how do you write your memoirs? How do you pass on your wisdom to your grandchildren? And that's partly based on recognizing that you're not going to be here. And that's one of the features of old age and adulthood, is the awareness that, you know, I'm not going to be here. And everything that I've ever thought, everything that I've ever learned, is going to disappear. It's going to be gone. It's gone. Everybody I've ever known, this is an interesting one, think about all the people you know. Everybody I know who's older than me dies before I do, and when I die, all of my knowledge of them, and I may be the last one alive who remembers them, is gone. So how do you pass it on, do you? How do you come to terms with the fact that you may not be able to pass on a lot of the knowledge that you've spent your life accumulating? That's why people get interested in writing books as they get older. Okay, an important idea. Another important idea. The text makes a good deal out of changes in intellectual development or intellectual performance across adult years. And they introduce the notion of crystallized and fluid intelligence. And this is based on the fact that if you look at intellectual tests, there are many different kinds of tests. And if you examine people over time, some kinds of skills stay the same or increase, like vocabulary, verbal fluency, tend to increase over adulthood, right on up into your 80s. Other kinds that depend on the functioning of the brain itself, meaning speed and accommodating new ideas, new things, learning new things quickly, those tend to decline. You don't do as well in your 40s and 50s as you did in your 30s. When things decline, we call them fluid. That means they're draining away. My skill at certain kinds of intellectual performance is draining away. It's fluid. I don't know where it goes, it just drains away. And other kinds are crystallized, which means they're solid and they stay. It's hard to get rid of them until your brain really starts to fall apart. So they make a big distinction in the text between crystallized and fluid intelligence. And what it means is that generally, you're going to stay about the same. Crystallized is going to increase because it's based on information and you get more information. And some kinds of things that are based on the speed of your response or processing things in completely novel ways are going to decline. The text gives you a fairly sophisticated and fancy way of distinguishing those two, some of which is probably accurate, but they tend to lose track of the fact that what makes something fluid is that it does decline. And what makes something crystallized is that it doesn't decline. And then after you discover what it is that doesn't decline, then you go try to figure out why it didn't. And that's the explanation that you have in the text. Another thing we talked about earlier in the biological unit is that No, that's not the one I want. I'm sorry. That some things appear to decline in early research. But if you look at the research, there's a reason why it seems to decline. And that is looking at what happens to particularly the fluid skills. 50, 60, 80. What happens is you see measures that look like this if you test people at different ages. And we tend to do this to those kinds of data points, and that's illegitimate, but we do it anyway. And what that suggests is that the intellectual skill is declining. But if you actually look at people over time, individuals over time, most of the skills don't do that. They look like that. Okay? And what's important in looking at this is that these are cross-sectional data, and they will typically show decline. And longitudinal data, which are based on the same person over time, will generally not show decline, or much less decline. What that means is, if you've been looking at these data, it makes you afraid to get old. But if you're looking at a longitudinal study, it's okay, because you're going to hang on to what you have. The reason this looks this way is that if you go in today and look at 70-year-olds and compare them to 30-year-olds, the 70-year-olds had much less good health in their childhoods. They have much less education, and their education is quite a bit longer ago. And if you're giving them the same test, the older people will do less well than the younger people. That's the cross-sectional flaw. But they're different people. The implication of this should scare you. The implication of this is that as you grow older, the people coming up behind you are going to get smarter. And that's an implication that the text doesn't talk about. You're going to be one of these. Your individual intelligence is not going to change. But we know now that the younger generation is getting smarter. Every generation is getting smarter. That's one of the unexplained things in psychological development. So you're going to be less smart. Right now you're more smart than me. I know more, but you're smarter. Don't test it. And what's going to happen to you is what happens to me. When you're 70, the younger generation is going to be quite a bit smarter than you are. And that's human progress and should be celebrated rather than worrying much about it. If it doesn't happen, then we need to worry. Okay, what did we learn? I've got half a minute. You can have it. I'll see you at Fleming's.